Hello everyone, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And we are historians. If this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we conduct intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians and other victims of the research bug.
We talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And we ask the question, what madness is this?
We'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which Claire and I are presently enjoying occupancy in what we call Melbourne today. That is the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, whose land was stolen and whose sovereignty was never ceded.
Today we are very excited to welcome historian and author Professor Mark McKenna into the Archives Anonymous Circle. Mark is one of Australia's leading historians based at the University of Sydney. He is the author of several prize-winning books, including From the Edge, Australia's Lost Histories, Looking for Blackfellas Point, and An Eye for Eternity, The Life of Manning Clark, which won the Prime Minister's Literary Award for Non-Fiction and the Victorian, New South Wales, Queensland and South Australian Premier's Awards. Mark is a frequent contributor of essays and reviews to The Monthly and authored the 2018 quarterly essay Moment of Truth, History and Australia's Future, in which he argued that Australians, both citizens and politicians, can only make momentous change for the future if we come to terms with our past, including, or especially, the truth of the frontier wars. Mark's latest book is Return to Uluru, which carries as its enticing blurb, a killing, a hidden history, a story that goes to the heart of the nation. And it's a book that has an archival journey at its narrative heart. So, of course, we just had to get Mark behind the mic. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Thanks very much, Claire. Thanks, Eve. It's great to be here. I'm already feeling better being inside the circle.
It's a safe space. Enjoy. Mark, we'll get to Return to Uluru in a minute, but for starters, I guess we have to acknowledge that you are a long-time chronic archive addict. Can you tell us when you first got bitten by the research bug?
I can. I guess that the years roll by and it's, you know, like 40 years or so since I first became an archive addict. It probably happened when I was in my early 20s in Germany. I was living with a group of politics students in Cologne. And one of them was a member of Friends of the Earth, one of the early green organisations. Anyway, he came home very excited one day and said, we all have to go down to the local library and read this United Nations report on climate change, Global 2000. Now, this was 1983. So, you know, global climate change was then not the kind of common thing it is now. So I went down to that library and read this UN report, did what I was told, and, you know, just sitting there and reading this report, which had fairly dire predictions of the effects of climate change, even in the early 80s from scientists, it just struck home to me again how, you know, like I always loved reading history and politics, the importance of libraries, archives, wherever I was in the world, you know, not only in Australia. And then I came back to Australia, started researching and writing Australian history in my late 20s, early 30s. I was a bit of a late starter because I was always wandering around here and there. And I guess also we've all experienced the kind of sensual side of the archives, you know, the smell of old paper, just the smell of libraries. Do they have a smell? Maybe they do. They do. You're nodding. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, they smell like home to me.
And that sense of quiet, solitude, and just being able to focus on something without interruption, and the broader collective importance of archives to all of us. You know, here we are at the moment doing this interview at a time when the National Archives, as you know, Claire and Eve, are under real threat because they don't have the money to fund what they need to do as a National Archive institution. And it's just a terrible state of affairs. Of course, we would say that, wouldn't we? We're historians. We can't have a future as a society and a nation unless we have our archives secure and we support them. So, yeah, I'm an archive rat and an archive defender.
So we've had a lot of people into Archives Anonymous here who are not historians, but who have similarly been bitten by the bug. And what we've really realised is that there's a kind of visceral feeling that people who have archive fever experience, no matter what background or training they come from. So tell us what archive fever feels like for you. Is it visceral? Is it a bodily affliction?
Can be at times. I think one of the things that is so alluring about archives here is that when you're outside in daily life, there's a lot of noise. It might be, you know, noise in the media, it might be noise in the back room or in the kitchen, or there's just noise. And so going to an archive is a chance to withdraw, to focus, and also to distill, to filter out that noise, and to just concentrate on text. Not only text, you know, people go to libraries to listen to things. They see things as well, but it's that withdrawal, it's that focus and concentration that archives allow us, and the kind of sense of discovery. No matter how well you think you know an archive, or you think you know what you're expecting to find, the joy of it is there's always, it doesn't happen every day, of course, some days can be laborious, but you can find a day where just suddenly, wow, you get this kind of eureka moment that you weren't expecting. You know, then you run out, you tell people, you tell your friends, hey, look at this. And so that's really exciting. I like that side of it, yeah.
And your friends look at you like you're crazy because it means nothing to them.
They do. And your, yes, people who are even close to you tell you that, you know, yeah, you live in your head, you know.
We do live in our heads. You live in your head, but you've also moved around this earth a lot, obviously, Mark. It's a long way from Cologne to Uluru. Tell us what drew you for this latest book to Uluru, or more particularly, tell us about the story of Bill McKinnon, the Northern Territory policeman who is the central protagonist in your story and, as it turns out, the possessor of an extraordinary personal archive.
As it turns out, yes, he was, he is. You know, he's dead now, of course, but an incredible archive that I discovered in the process of writing this book. Who is Bill McKinnon? Well, Bill McKinnon is a policeman who took up a job in Central Australia in 1931 and very shortly, within a few years, found himself at the centre of a Commonwealth Board of Inquiry into his actions shooting an Aboriginal man at Uluru. The whole way I discovered Bill McKinnon's archive is a good example of how we should let our books be hijacked at times by intruders who come in from the outside and sort of take things over because we find things in the archive, and that's what happened to me. So I kind of always knew about Bill McKinnon. You know, I knew about this shooting at Uluru and the Commonwealth Board of Inquiry, but I think half of me is a biographer. I asked, you know, well, what happened in this policeman's life? As historians, we look at moments in the past and we understandably burrow down into those particular moments and we have our actors in those moments, but we don't always ask ourselves what happens outside of our sphere of interest. What is it about our actors that we think might not be relevant but actually might be relevant? So I asked myself, well, you know, who was this man? What happened in his life before that shooting? What happened afterwards? And then through that process, you know, the short story, I was surfing on the net. No, surfing is not the right word. You know, researching on the net late one night, and I inadvertently typed in McKinnon's name. And then up came a donation that his daughter had made to the Queensland Art Gallery in the early 2000s. And it was a work by Albert Namatjira, one of the first Namatjira artworks that he had commissioned. Bill McKinnon, my policeman, had asked Albert to memorialise him on this these mulga wood plaques, poker work engravings. He'd paid him for it too. But this donation had his daughter's name. And then I could trace him, trace her at least, because I had her married name. Went onto the white pages and old-fashioned, and then I found her, and she was so generous. Mark, if you want to, I have a few things of my father's in the garage. This was the turning point for me, because then once I went on the plane up to Brisbane, it was like a every historian's fairy tale. There in the corner of the garage in old trunks, as well as Marilyn Monroe films on reel to reel, was every journal this man kept from the moment of the shooting right through to the end of his life. You know, as an archive fiend, or whatever word you like to use, this was even more exciting, because this was an archive kept in someone's home. It was in a garage. It had been nurtured. It had been protected. So a lot of things were in specially sealed plastic bags. This was someone who really wanted to make sure that what he had would be seen by someone else. So I immediately then became aware of Bill McKinnon's historical consciousness, that he was someone who was a keeper of things. And as we know, if you keep things, you've got more chance of being written about. If you don't keep things, not much chance. But I wouldn't go so far as to say he saw someone coming along and writing this. But anyway, in the trunks, like there it was, the journal that he kept the morning after that shooting, and in his own handwriting, he had always told the Board of Inquiry in 1935, I just fired into the cave at Uluru near Mutijulu Waterhole. I just fired into the cave, quote, without taking aim, right? But there in his own handwriting. And why did he leave this here? I don't have an answer to that still. But were the words, I fired to hit. So I knew he was lying. What did one of his grandchildren said, oh, that's the smoking gun, you know, you've got the smoking gun. Yeah, okay, I guess that's true, I did. But I had much more than the smoking gun. I had this obsessive individual, some would say anal, who just sort of kept recording everything about his life. So every journey to Woolworths, every pineapple he bought, every time he pulled weeds out of the garden or put a wrong sock on, it was in that journal. And so although that wasn't kind of all pertinent to my story, it helped me to build a picture of this man. And I think I only use one or two examples of all the other bits in his life that he recorded. A beautiful one where he said he went to some town in Queensland and he bought three pineapples and threw two away. That I really like that one. Why would you write that down? But he did. It has a kind of Ulysses-like effect, you know, and it becomes very moving to see someone committed to that kind of recording and logging of their lives. He sort of taught me too that it's not only historians who have this association with this connection through documents to a future that we're talking to, but we can never really talk to, but we're kind of trying to talk to it. So that was interesting. Yeah.
In the way that you've talked about McKinnon, you know, really self-consciously curating his own legacy, I have to say it reminds me of one of your previous subjects, Manning Clark, who, as you wrote in your prize-winning biography of him, Clark was very conscious of himself as a historical figure and wrote notes to his future biographer in his archives. So even though these two men, McKinnon and Clark, are in many ways, you know, very different, led very different lives, this sort of sense of building a kind of archival monument to themselves seems to be a kind of common theme between them. I'm wondering, is this just a coincidence, or do you think you as a historian are drawn to these kind of figures and the archival remnants they leave behind?
That's a good question. Yeah, I wouldn't like to think that I somehow attract them or drawn to them, but I guess, yeah, that comparison crossed my mind, you know, because I thought, oh, I've got another Manning here, except Joe. He didn't sort of write on top of documents, one of my abusers, or this person is bad, or, you know. Yeah, But I think that experience I had, you know, writing that Clark biography really alerted me to question every archive and ask the question, why is this archive here? Who put it here? For what purpose is it here? And I think with every archive, although MacKinnon, you know, you can see in that garage, you know, he collected art about Central Australia. He collected every book that was published about Central Australia. He collected everything he could about himself, right? So if he was mentioned for whatever purpose in the newspaper, that was cut out. So there's a Manning similarity again. Manning left you in no doubt as to when he appeared in the press because he kept it all. My ears were already pricked, they were already ready for this kind of thing. And I think as writers and historians, we have to be really increasingly aware of the intentions of the people who put the documents there and what that means for us as writers and the questions we have to ask, which I guess might be part of the reason you're focusing on this whole show, which is fantastic.
In terms of what that means for us as historians, I mean, the obvious effect of MacKinnon having this vast personal archive is that he comes to the fore in your book. I mean, on one level, the book is the story of two men, MacKinnon, the murderer, and his victim, Jochen Unner. But it's MacKinnon who we kind of get to know in a kind of three-dimensional, fleshed-out way. It's, you know, pictures of him with his wife and his daughter, and we read his love poetry, his quite bad love poetry, and we get all those, you know, mundane details of him that brings him to life in a way we don't get for his victim, Jochen Unner, because those details don't survive.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing, isn't it? As I was writing the book, I kept getting frustrated by, like, here I am. This is a classic example, you know. Oh, I can flesh this white man out because I've got all these archives. But when it comes to the Aboriginal character of Jochen Unner, it's so hard to do that. And then I thought, well, maybe also, you know, that's a European question about trying to flesh Jochen Unner out as an individual, right? Because Aboriginal people can only be understood in relation, of course, to everyone, the community. One could say the same about us, but however, it's even more so, I think, for them. So then I thought, oh, yeah, I can't do it, but then maybe it's sort of not the, I couldn't do it anyway. I could only do it by talking to all the mob and it would become a different book. And even then, a lot of that might have been lost. So, yeah, you know, it's again an example of how there's so much more in the making and creation of history and its conventions. They lend themselves much more to European than Indigenous. It's just a fact.
Yeah, completely.
But Mark, you are very sensitive to the silences in the record. I think one of the most striking elements of this book is that you weave your own research journey through it. You know, you've got that gotcha moment in the Brisbane garage, and that's the climax of your own historian's quest.
Mm.
But you've also got some beautiful turns of phrase along the way about some of the smaller twists and turns. For example, when Numberland and Nunji leave prison after they serve their terms for the murder of Kai Uman, you write, "Once outside the prison walls, they walked out of history." Can you expand on that wonderful tragic image?
Yeah, thanks for picking that out. Yeah, you're the first person to do that, so that's great. Yeah, again, the question is a good one because it goes to the question of writing. So I could have elaborated on that in the writing. I could have gone further, but I got to the stage in my work where I sort of prefer to just to pare it back as far as I can and leave it. So what I didn't elaborate on, but I hope is there in that sentence, is that when we're writing, it doesn't have to be Indigenous history, you know, it can be any history, but especially with Indigenous history, that so often our Indigenous figures move in and out of our narrative when they exist in the documents. And I know we can't control, you know, you can't control this, but it's how you manage that. I mean, what do you do with that reality? You're limited. These figures are in my book, but they can somehow only exist in my history for what I've got for them. They disappear. They disappear. Literally, when they're not in the archives, they disappear. From my text, They disappear from us. They fall through our fingers. We can't reach them. So yeah, I guess that's what I was trying to get at, to hint or suggest, imply that there's so much that you can't reach that you just have to accept. They've gone. They've gone from history.
They've gone from colonial history.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
what you also really show is that the book is a tale of two archives. I mean, you set the documentary record against the local Indigenous story of Yokonuna's death, which you also endeavour to uncover and to interpret. How much harder was it for you to work in this oral archive, largely handed down in a language that you don't speak, which also sometimes contradicted the documentary record on questions that you'd have to consider fact?
Yeah, that was very difficult. All of that process was very, very hard. As I got deeper and deeper into this, I quickly realised I need almost an interpreter, you might say, or I need a mediator. You know, I was very fortunate that Sammy Wilson, who's one of the senior custodians of Uluru and is also, yeah, of course, one of the descendants of the one of the men who was chased to Uluru and also Yokonuna, who was shot, that his partner, Kathy Tozer, spoke Pitjantjatjara. And so Sammy would speak and she would translate for me. And, you know, the first moment that I had to tell them on the phone that his ancestors' remains were in the museum in South Australia, because I couldn't do it in person because of COVID. First I had a phone conversation, then I had a Zoom conversation. So that was a powerful moment for me, which actually I don't even know if I put this in the book, but anyway, what happened was I was speaking to Kathy on the phone and then she was translating to Sammy. And that moment was, you know, we all know there are hundreds of Indigenous languages, some more lost than others and so on. But when you are a historian, you're hearing your questions translated back and forth, and yeah, wow, that was so powerful and a real sort of reminder that to me that I had to really make sure I did them justice. You know, that's one of the hardest things, I think, is to allow all of my Indigenous voices to speak without me writing over the top of them, or just to genuinely have them there saying what they say, to let their voices hang there without overinterpreting them. Let the reader do that.
Mark, in addition to liaising and talking to the descendants of Yokonuna, the man who was killed by Bill McKinnon, you also built a relationship with Bill McKinnon's descendants. You know, as you've described to us, you found his personal archive in the garage of his daughter, and you got to know his grandson as well. And as you describe beautifully in the book, these family members kind of had to come to terms with the fact that their beloved father and grandfather was, you know, on the wrong side of the frontier wars. You've mentioned elsewhere that you were planning to sort of talk to them once the book had come out and then had a chance to sort of read and digest it. I wondered, have you done that yet, and how did that go?
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. This is sort of something I hope to write about maybe in the more distant future, because it's too close at the moment to write about it. 2 months, was it? When was it? Anyway, 6-7 weeks ago, I was up in Brisbane and I went there explicitly to meet the family. I'd always said to them, look, you know, if you want me to come up after you've read the book and talk about it, I will. I knew pretty quickly that they didn't know anything about the history. So to their credit, they said to me, I got the text, well, can you come up? So up I went. And well, as I asked them when I got there, I said, so, you know, there were about 5 or 6 people around the table. This, I'd never, you know, never done anything like this before. Can you imagine? I mean, as a historian, going into a family whose grandfather, because of the book, you know, it ended up as national news and they'd all read the book and they didn't know about this history. I said, you know, I asked them, I said, oh, how did you feel at the end of it? I said, how'd you feel before we started today? I said, very apprehensive. I said, oh, so did I, you know. I was there for 4 hours. It was difficult at times because McKinnon's daughter, Susan, was sitting next to me, but she has some issues that make it hard for her now to comprehend questions or, you know, conversation. But she was there nonetheless, right next to me. And, you know, his only daughter. And then on the other, around the table were her children, McKinnon's grandchildren. And they'd prepared lunch and coffee. And so we had long conversation about the book, and they'd made notes and they asked me questions about the book. One of the ones that I thought I'd get was, wasn't he just doing his job? You know, wasn't he just sort of doing what any policeman would do? Here was technically someone who was an escaped prisoner. Yeah. So resisting arrest. Yeah. So he had to apprehend him by whatever means if he was resisting arrest. Mm-hmm. And this was interesting because it's not like a seminar. You know, when we're normally in that kind of context, we are, as historians or writers, we're talking about our work around a table. Well, it's a seminar or it's a discussion, but this was very different. This was a kind of, not inquisition, it was a family trying to come to terms with this. And so I couldn't reply in the same way that I would in a seminar. I went through with that question and I said, well, the Commonwealth Board of Inquiry was set up in 1935 into that shooting, because even in 1935, it was not considered okay to do what McKinnon did, which is why they looked into it. And, you know, I went through all of the stages in the shooting and what he could have done, the alternatives to what happened. You know, there were alternatives. He didn't have to shoot him, especially given that the man was unarmed. I mean, defenseless, right? Yeah. You know, that was a difficult conversation. And there was a kind of, I think, a wariness too that, you know, they don't want to become the spokespersons for reconciliation for white Australia. And that's understandable. You know, they feel that pressure. They probably at the moment will go to the, or some of them will go to the repatriation of Yohanana's remains at Uluru. That's a great thing. And I think it's important, like I tried to get across to them, well, if you're going to do that, you know, that is a statement. Your presence is a statement. You shouldn't feel that you have to give an address. You're there. That will be enough. So it's unfolding, and I can't talk. There are other things going on, possibilities of various maybe television or, you know, film stuff, and whether they will be involved or not. And so there's a lot I can't talk about, but they have been, like, overall, they've been fantastic and very generous and patient. And you can't help but think in those situations of, you know, when you go into that family situation, you see your own family.
Mark, that sounds like that moment around the dining room table with you present was a kind of truth and reconciliation moment, just as the family being at the repatriation of Yohanana's remains at Uluru will be a kind of truth and reconciliation moment. It's not surprising that your book becomes a meditation on the Uluru Statement from the Heart, and in particular that document's demand that calls for truth-telling. At one point, discussing the Uluru family who still live at Mutijula today, you write that, and I'm quoting you here, the white fellow lineage of discoverers, pioneers, station owners, police, scientists, missionaries, humanitarians, and murderers is threaded through the family history of Uluru's custodians like barbed wire. I'm really interested in the role of the contemporary white historian in unthreading the tangled and thorny strands of the past. Are historians savior figures? Or should historians be included in that very list of rogues who have bound and gagged Indigenous families and their histories for over two centuries now?
Yeah, great question. Should historians be included in that list? Some of them, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say, in a sense, you know, I'm trying to avoid being, the whole thing is about to do it in a way in which I'm not part of the barbed wire. But we're all implicated in it. Once we meddle in it, once we start becoming the storyteller, we change the nature of what's there. It becomes something else, at least for some readers and so on. But, you know, we know the argument, we're all familiar with it, that writing history is an extension of the colonial sort of theft and so on, right? But I think that if you can genuinely collaborate, if you can genuinely try and be as inclusive as possible, then you can not add to the injury. You can show all of the complex, well, you know, as many complexities as you're able to comprehend, show all that, but not actually make it worse, I guess, you know. You know, another way of answering this is, like, when I first had the Zoom conversation with the family at Uluru, I thought, oh, you know, what are they going to say here? Because imagine telling them this news, this white fellow historian, you know, they've known about this story for, of course, nearly 100 years. They don't need me to come along and tell them. But, of course, what I also had to tell them was that MacKinnon had lived till his 90s, that he'd come back to the Rock in the 80s, 50 years after this, that their ancestors' remains were in the museum. And the first thing that they said to me shocked me, and that was, thank you for finding this out. Yeah? Now, that blew me away because there wasn't any kind of sense. They weren't angry or they weren't sort of annoyed with me because I'd intruded on this. They were thankful, right? Maybe I just got lucky. As you know, it's an enormously ethically complicated affair and dilemma. And there have been times, I must confess, when I've asked myself, will I go on writing in this area? Will I go on? Because it's becoming increasingly fraught. And I think any historian who's not Indigenous has to ask themselves the question, am I the best person to write this story? And I think some of those stories might be better to leave. There might be different answers for different situations, but I think you have to ask the question.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things for this conversation for us, Mark, is that we are practitioners in this field as well, and these are thorny ethical issues, and we are all working through them all the time. And these are questions that we ask ourselves. And I guess I'm interested, I'm writing Indigenous history for the first time in the book that I'm writing at the moment, but this is a field that you've ploughed many times before. Are you asking yourself as a practitioner, as a researcher, different questions now than you did on your earlier book, say, Looking for Blackfellas Point?
Yes. I think, like, every book is of its moment, yeah? And I think Blackfellas Point was riding into that space about reconciliation and the Bringing Them Home report and the history wars. It was riding into all of that. And the politics was different at that time. That book was published in nearly 20 years ago, like 2002, which freaks me out. But anyway, 2002. So you do ask yourself, or you should be asking yourself, different questions because the context is shifting in which your work is appearing. So by the time with From the Edge, for example, where I was writing on Cooktown, at the end of that book, I think the chapter on Cooktown in that book mirrors the approach in some ways that I've taken in Return to Uluru. So that book was published in 2016, and I made a big effort there with the help of Alberta Hornsby, who's one of the senior Gugu Yimata elders in Cooktown, to collaborate in the writing of that chapter. So I definitely think my work had become more collaborative, genuinely collaborative, as it moved on over time. But that's also, I think, I was able to do that because things had changed, you know, the context had shifted. At the same time, you know, in response to what we were just saying before, lurking underneath all of this is the possibility we should only write about what we experience, or that we as white historians shouldn't be writing about, or white novelists, right? Take your pick. And I'm of the view that I wouldn't like to see us get to that point. I think that what counts, what matters, is the spirit in which you write, in the spirit in which you research, and that's what really matters above all else. And at the same time, as I said, there are some stories you probably do have to walk away from. So it's not like I'm saying carte blanche, but I think it's, I wouldn't like to get to a situation where each writer can only write about their experience, because we cut off a lot of the imaginative tension in writing, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, if we get to that position.
Mark, we haven't got much time left, but we've gotten pretty down to it here. I'd like to come at it at a slightly different angle as well. One of the facets of your storytelling that comes through very clearly is the gendered nature of the colonial project. This was a land of rugged, strong man, taming, indeed penetrating the central Australian frontier. That word penetrating comes from a primary source document that you use.
Mm.
And you write that, as ever, masculine metaphors were the frontier literary artillery of European conquest. Great sentence, by the way. You're referring to the writing of explorers like Stuart and later chroniclers like Cecil Madigan and even MacKinnon himself, who identified very much as being a fellow traveller with this man, a fellow seeker of the centre. Did you see yourself as in any way continuing this tradition, as
not
penetrating a previous silent and untrammeled archive?
With your penetrative masculine gaze.
Oh, dear, yes, yeah. Where'll we go with that? So did I see myself in that? I suppose, again, I'd say that I was aware of that. I was aware of that. It's very hard for me to critique my own writing or to interpret my own work. I resist that, you know, for obvious reasons. I think it's better to stay away from it. I would hope that somewhere in the tone and colour of the language that there's a resistance to continuing that masculine metaphor. I would hope that it doesn't fall into that vein.
I don't think it does.
But it's like, it's a good question, because you could say that the whole quest of the, use that metaphor again of penetration, of the centre, right? Yeah. It's a masculine idea, of course. But I didn't feel the urge to do that, that I was trying to penetrate the centre. No. I was kind of circling around it, I think. MacKinnon, you mentioned MacKinnon, you know, so that moment where he's down in Adelaide and his wife is giving birth to their only child, as it turned out, and he writes back to his brother and says, geez, you know, 2 or 3 days in hospital with a woman, with baby, you know, I want to be back with the bloke sort of having a drink or something. And you just think, oh, God, you know. I mean, is he just writing for his brother, for the masculine audience? Is that what he really felt? Probably, I think. Yeah, it's probably true. But when you read that, you know, 1930s, yeah, I think I would hope that you wouldn't find a policeman leaving the hospital today and writing to his brother that he was keen to get back to the boys in the pub. Maybe, I don't know, could be wrong. Yeah. I've still got that question ringing in my ears, Claire. So I've got a little bits of answers, but I can't.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in addition to penetrating the centre being a kind of masculinist metaphor, you could even say that the historian's quest to know and conquer and penetrate the archive is inherently masculinist in its kind of implicit drive for domination and knowledge.
Knowledge, yes, but not domination.
But, well, you could say that to know is to control. Okay. Go down there.
Well, yeah, no, it's interesting. It's a good argument. Good question. I mean, so, yeah, definitely, you know, knowledge, of course, is authority. Knowledge is power. Knowledge is command.
Yeah, Foucault.
Yeah, but domination, that is the action to which the knowledge is put and how it's used, and that doesn't have to be in that dominating spirit. I guess I, with this book I was trying, don't know if I've been successful, but I was trying to write in a way in which the narrative was open-ended enough and there was enough space for the reader to do the interpretive work as well, that it wasn't just me, the author, doing that. But hey, you know, I'm sure I didn't resist all of the time doing the interpretation, but I tried.
It's a very successful book, Mark. It's not a big book, but there is so much in it, and we know people are absolutely going to flock to it just as they do to the centre itself. We're going to have to wind things up, but we'll just ask you one question. Archive Fever is supposed to be a safe space for sharing, even though it possibly was a challenging space today as well. But one thing that we ask people is whether they would like to share with us a dirty little archive secret that they have always harboured.
Yes, got a few of those. I can answer that by being indirect, yeah. So there are times in my life as a historian where I have probably been guilty of fishing for being the catalyst for provoking, niggling, trying to get an answer from someone about something that I know if I get what I'm after will be worth keeping. I can't elaborate more than that. But anyway, it's like it's more to do with the Republic debate, which I was involved in a little bit in the 90s. And,
very mysterious.
Yeah.
An archival provocateur.
You know, what I mean is that some people might say things privately but wouldn't say in public. And if I ask the right questions to certain individuals, I might get answers that are worth keeping for the record, that sort of thing. So what I'm saying is, I guess at times I've been a bit of an archive collector as well as archive finder. I know that's very oblique, but I can't give you more details or I'll get myself in trouble.
What did you call them? Oh, you had a great word for it. You called Bill McKinnon this, the filers and the keepers.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a bit of filing that's going on.
I think there's a bit of that in me, Claire.
It's a beautiful quality. We value it here at Archive Fever. Mark, thank you so much for coming along today. It's been a really fascinating conversation. It's given us all a lot to think about, but I'm afraid that is all we have time for today. Return to Uluru is published in Australia by Black Ink. Clearly, you're all going to rush out and buy it now so you can follow Mark's journey in discovering his smoking gun in the garage. Don't forget that you can catch up on all of season 1 and 2 of Archive Fever via our website, archivefeverpod.com. So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com. And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright.
And you can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees. And you can't follow Mark on Twitter because he's far too sensible to be there.
Coming up on the next episode.
In my studio, which I'm now pointing to, is about 50 dolls and bears, and each one of them represents something different. And they all sit around my desk. Other people find it really spooky, all looking at me.